I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Sometimes it seems as though we have exhaustively examined every last story of the Second World War, and then a book comes along that shares a story largely unknown. That is what we examine today because of an extraordinary new book called Ensnared in the Wolf's Lair. Inside the 1944 plot to kill Hitler and the ghost children of his revenge. The story of the plot, the actually multiple plots, to assassinate Adolf Hitler and bring down the Third Reich from within, that story is somewhat well known. But almost completely unknown is the story of Adolf Hitler's reprisal, of his seek for revenge in the wake of that of those assassination attempts, and in particular the one that very nearly did end his life. And that is the story of this remarkable book, and it is written by a Wisconsin-based writer named Anne Bossom, who has written extensively on various historical topics, many of them in and around themes of social justice, including the March Against Fear. This book, like at least a couple of others written by Anne Awesome, is published by National Geographic. Again, it's titled Ensnared in the Wolf's Lair, Inside the 1944 Plot to Kill Hitler and the Ghost Children of His Revenge. Anne Bossom, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's wonderful to connect on Wisconsin soil.
Absolutely. Thank you for being part of The Morning Show today. So you have done extensive work in the field of history, and I'm sure know history well. I wonder, though, how much you knew at all about this story of the so-called ghost children before you began writing this book.
Truthfully, Greg, I knew next to nothing. In 2014, my publisher suggested I think about World War II history, and was so keen on having me do that that they actually said, you know, we think if you go to Europe, you'll find something, and we'll give you a budget, and just go acquaint yourself with the history. And I had put up all kinds of objections, including that I didn't speak German, that I hadn't been to Germany in decades, and they had confidence that I would find something, so I went in 2015, and there had been an early suggestion from them of a story that was related to the Wolf's Lair, which is where that assassination plot took place in 1944, the Valkyrie plot. And so I went to the Wolf's Lair, the Wolfschanze, in the deep winter of 2015, and was very much captivated by the mood of the spot. It's a very eerie place, particularly in the middle of winter. And I did a lot of other fact-finding across Germany, but I really didn't come away with a hook. but I did gain a lot of background knowledge. And truthfully, what kicked this book off was the 2018 policy of separating children from parents on the southern border, and that called to mind an exhibit that I had seen about the separation of children from parents following this failed plot. And as you mentioned, I tend to write about social justice, and that seemed like something that was in my wheelhouse.
Hmm. One of the things that you tell us about this move to separate children from their parents in the wake of this failed assassination plot, something called Sippenhaft, or clan arrest or family punishment, that there is actually very little in the way of documentation. The way that there, in contrast to many other facets of the kind of the Nazi horror, the Nazi machine that is meticulously documented, this is not. And so you really, I think, probably had quite a challenge ahead of you in terms of trying to uncover information about this. Just how obscure a story are we talking about?
Well, it was obscure in Germany until after the unification. And then as the reunified Germany began to try to reconnect strands of history, stories started to emerge that had just not risen to the fore in previous decades. And so by the 90s, this was becoming somewhat known. And one reason is because eyewitnesses to the history survived. And the children who were separated from their parents as part of this clan arrest or family punishment are in their 70s and 80s now. And some of them started doing interviews, and more importantly, a diary emerged that had been kept by one of them, a 12-year-old girl named Christa von Hofacker, who had started a diary to just help her process the chaos that had enveloped her family after her father got arrested for his involvement in this plot. And so that diary is actually a remarkable primary source document of her experiences, and it's one of the key records that we have of it. Many of the other records were seemingly destroyed in an attempt to obscure what had happened. And because this is, as you point out, one of those small stories that's easy to overlook in the horror of the wider Nazi atrocity, is one that was just overlooked. So it didn't rise to the top, as I said.
Hmm. Fortunately, through your book, we can learn much more about this really poignant and powerful story. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Anne Bossom about her latest book, which comes to us from the good folks at National Geographic. It is titled Ensnared in the Wolf's Lair, Inside the 1944 Plot to Kill Hitler and the Ghost Children of His Revenge. One of the things I appreciate about your book is that although it doesn't take long for you to kind of get to the heart of the matter in terms of the multiple plots to try to assassinate Adolf Hitler, you also take a little bit of time at the outset of the book to sort of set this in context. That is to, in a sense, summarize Adolf Hitler's rise to power and, in a sense, the sort of national attitudes that he sort of preyed upon and exacerbated in order to cement himself in a really almost impregnable position of power. I'm just curious, as you wrote this part of the book, telling the story of Hitler and the rise of the Nazis, what was most important to you to convey to us, the reader, in terms of setting the main story of this book in proper context?
I think Americans have not always done a good job of learning the history of other countries. We don't necessarily even understand our own history particularly well. And so I thought it was important to make as clear and concise a case as possible to answer the question, how in the world did this happen? How did Hitler rise to power? And since my primary audience is younger readers who are coming to it for the first time, it seemed particularly important to outline just how a demagogue can seize the minds of the people and corrupt them to the point where they act beyond reason. And furthermore, then once he secures his power, completely, just how difficult it is then to unseat him.
Right.
And that then helps to explain why it took so long for this plot to bring into action, and why it was so challenging for it, and really rather astonishing that it was even attempted.
Exactly. In this chapter called Hitler's Rise, I think one sentence was I found especially chilling in kind of describing the sort of the machinery of the Nazi Party and the way in which it began to kind of indoctrinate so much of the German population. You write, the pattern repeated itself throughout the country, lies and fear, lies and fear. And let's read those words and we realize that is such a dangerous thing when those, let's call them weapons, are wielded effectively.
Absolutely. And if you'll indulge me, I'll read the quote that sets up this chapter that's from an eyewitness, a linguist, who made the observation shortly after the war, words can be like tiny doses of arsenic. They are swallowed unnoticed, appear to have no effect, and then after a little time, the toxic reaction sets in after all. Mm. And when I constructed this chapter, I didn't realize how prescient it would be in terms of even our own national history, where in recent months, lies have become truths for many people in a way that's equally chilling. Mm.
In the second chapter called Resisting the Regime, you, in a sense, open with a photograph that I have never seen. In fact, I've never seen a photograph anything like it before. And it is some kind of demonstration that is against the Nazis. It's in 1932. And we see a banner at the center of which is a swastika with three lines drawn through it, evidently a symbol used by those who in the early going demonstrated against the Nazis. I found all kinds of things surprising, but I suppose chiefly among them, I just don't ever remember hearing anything about people resisting the Nazis that early. I mean, really before the full horror of the Nazi Party was widely recognized. And I found that really intriguing, and I suppose that's also a really important stepping stone as you proceed to the rest of your story.
Yeah, and you make a good point, because this honestly was a revelation to me too, and I think perhaps we've done a poor job sharing that fact with our own telling of history, because originally, we were constructing a history that just sort of was black and white. We were the good guys. They were the bad guys. Hitler was in charge. Americans went over and helped us save the day. And it's so much more nuanced than that. There were multiple groups, and Hitler had mechanisms that quietly snuffed them out or quickly snuffed them out. And more would rise, and perhaps act more subtly, more under the radar, so to speak, and not even knowing necessarily that other groups were doing the same thing. But there was an ongoing simmering resistance throughout the regime, or at least through this period that culminates with this attack in July 20, 1944.
You tell us that as early as 1941, there were people already hatching plots to try and assassinate Hitler, or in one way or another, to bring him down. I mean, so serious were the misgivings even that early in the Second World War. And one of the things you say that I think is very helpful context, you write, the complexity of the challenge they faced, that is, those trying to end this, the challenge they faced helps account for the lag between resolve and action. So many questions needed to be considered and answered. Should Hitler be killed, or should he be arrested? I mean, I'd never stopped to think about that as well, that for those engaged in the increasingly dangerous matter of resistance and resistance to the point of trying to take Hitler down one way or another, they had to try to figure out under very trying circumstances what is the best way to accomplish that. And I, again, never stopped to really consider the way in which they were confronted with those kind of very difficult choices.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And there's disagreement. There are people who feel like, if we assassinate him, then we're no better than the regime. And others who felt like that's the only way we're going to be able to just do in this force of evil, that an arrest would not be sufficient, that you needed something more conclusive.
And is it as simple a matter as the fact that Germany was losing this war, that even relatively early on, there were those in the know who were realizing that this was a doomed venture, and that they were all likely to be consumed by it unless Hitler could somehow be stopped? I mean, is that the kind of the heart and soul of why there was this effort to bring Hitler down?
Well, that was certainly a key factor, and many of the people involved in this this simmering plot were members of the military. Some were career officers, others had been placed in those positions when everybody was mobilized to support the war effort. They had been executives before, and then became military leaders, but they felt the same responsibility for the men under their command that officers would feel today for their soldiers. And Hitler turned out to be a pretty lousy military strategist, and he was getting a lot of soldiers killed. And these were their soldiers, and that was just offensive and, from a pure military standpoint, bad business for a military to be wasting its troops. So there was outrage on that level. There was outrage because of the atrocities that were taking place by Nazi, these private Nazi militias that would come along behind the troops and were murdering undesirables and leaders and so forth in conquered territories. This was the opening shades of what would become the Holocaust. There was the outrage as these leaders began to hear rumors of the Holocaust itself, and so all of that was driving their determination that something needed to be done. But on the other hand, all of them had sworn a military oath of allegiance to Hitler himself, and these were people who took oaths seriously. They were used to following directions, so there was this moral conundrum of, you know, do we betray our oath because we have this higher loyalty to our country? Will that be recognized? It took a long time to puzzle that out, too.
Mm. We're speaking with Anne Bossom about her book, Ensnared in the Wolf's Lair, Inside the 1944 Plot to Kill Hitler and the Ghost Children of His Revenge. So, although there are various plans made and, in a sense, unmade and new plans revised about trying to assassinate Adolf Hitler and achieve what would amount to a coup, and there are more than one actual attempt made, the central attempt is in this plot that I think was codenamed Valkyrie. And you devote an entire chapter to that, which includes not only plans for the assassination of Hitler, but then for other things to happen in other places all around Germany to, in a sense, effect the removal of the top echelon of Nazis from power. I'd never stopped to think about that either. That I mean, I'd heard about this assassination plot, but I guess I'd simplistically thought that you take Hitler down and the whole thing collapses. And this plot in 1944 was about much more than just assassinating Hitler.
Exactly, because you had Gestapo agents, you had Nazi officials, you had SA troops scattered all over Europe, who were essentially a private security force and military force under Hitler's command. There were he had people who were close to him who would have stepped in to take his place if he had been assassinated. So a good deal of thought went into, you know, how do you kill as many of those top people as possible, not just Hitler? And some of the attempts were set aside because it didn't seem like enough people were going to be killed in these bombings that were principally targeting him. But then also trying to recruit people at, you know, in Paris, in Prague, in Vienna, who could have troops loyal to them who would follow them against, you know, not just these officers breaking their oaths, but would have the military forces required to round up hundreds of Gestapo agents, SA forces, et cetera, at gunpoint and be prepared to execute them, you know, have instant trials and execute them as traitors to Germany.
Mm. Well, you outline this plot in detail in this chapter, and of course it is a plot that ultimately fails, and we'll leave it to our listeners to explore this on their own. What your book then primarily takes up from that point on is what occurs in the wake of this, let's call it a failed coup attempt, which ends up being a far more extensive plot than had initially been realized by the Nazis. At one point you write, as they began to kind of uncover more and more details about who was involved, Nazi officials were astonished as they started to tug at the tangled knot of betrayals. And it's really interesting to think about what those Nazi officials thought as they begin to realize just how many people were involved in this coup attempt. How many of, in a sense, their brethren?
Right, exactly. People who were there, who were national heroes, like General Erwin Rommel, who was, the poster child for the military excellence, who was in on the plot too, and was forced to commit suicide or else be betrayed and have his family punished. And his death was presented, whitewashed, as being the result of some wounds that he had recently received. But the thought that Rommel would turn against Hitler must have unsettled him greatly and the others, because it just showed how deep the betrayal was within the teams that had seemed loyal.
Right. And then they had to think on some level, I should think, what do they know that we don't know? Or there must be something for all of these people to be turning against Hitler. It's a fascinating facet of this story. Well, in the wake of this, of course, those who are discovered to have been part of this are brought to quick and inhumane justice. But then beyond that, then Hitler decides to impose this practice of Sippenhaft, or clan arrest, in which not only people directly involved in this coup attempt are arrested, but in effect, members of their family as well, including even children. First of all, is this essentially unprecedented, or had we seen anything like this before from the Nazis?
No, the policy of Sippenhof existed throughout the Nazi regime. This was one of Hitler's tools of terror, and the way he kept the population in check, because everyone knew that there were spies everywhere. Your neighbors could be spying on you. The Gestapo agents were certainly aware of what you were doing. People were listening in onto telephone calls. And if you got in trouble, it wasn't just you that would get punished. Your family might, too. And the conspirators knew that their family might get swept up in this. They did their best, many of them, to keep the families completely unaware of anything so that they had complete deniability of knowledge of what had happened. So it was not a new practice, but it was unusual in that many of these people were, many of the conspirators were from the former aristocracy of Germany. These were people who still had titles like Count and Baron in their names. And so when the Gestapo showed up to arrest people, they were arresting countesses and baronesses and putting them in prison. And so that was a shocking thing, even though in theory the aristocracy had been ended. Nonetheless, these were household names, like Rommel is to us. And so that made it a somewhat more delicate operation, and yet they persisted, and they did round up hundreds of relatives and dozens of children as young as 10 years old.
Hmm. One of the things I found especially chilling in the way that this was carried out was that, if I understand correctly, in many cases, Gestapo agents would show up on the doorstep and a mother might be taken away for questioning or detention or whatever. And while she was gone and the children are left in the care of the nurse or the neighbor or whatever, more agents would come and take the children away. So in some cases, you would have a mother returning home eventually only to find that her children had been taken away without her knowledge.
Exactly.
And one thing we read over and over again in your book are the two words, no explanation. No explanation. I mean, agents showing up at someone's doorstep to take them away with no explanation. And it seems to me that that is probably at the heart of what this was all about, and it just makes a terrible situation, in a sense, even more unbearable.
Yeah, I think one of the things I learned exploring this history and talking to these you know, now octogenarian survivors of it is just how terror can take many forms. You know, we can certainly appreciate how terrifying the experiences during the Holocaust were. That's a form of terror that's immediately just horrifying to contemplate, putting ourselves in those situations and knowing other people experienced that. But there is this more insidious kind, insidious kind of terror that just simmers below the surface. And you know, not knowing the answer, like you say, no explanation. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know why I'm being taken there. I've got, you know, I'm 12 years old. This is the diarist, Krista. I'm 12 years old. I've got my 6-year-old, and I think he was an 8-year-old brother with me. I'm trying to keep them from freaking out. I've got these Gestapo agents who are very intimidating. I'm riding on the train for days. I don't know where we're going. When we finally get off the train, we walk I think it was a 2-mile walk they had to take. And imagine a 6-year-old gone on a 2-mile walk, going to a place they don't even know where they're going. And then they get there, and The one comfort they've had is the three children are together, and the brother's actually nine, not eight. But the three children are separated, so they don't even have that comfort. And they're told their last names have been changed, so they don't have their identity is being undermined. Just at every level, this regime knew how to take away your sense of security and create this just pulse of terror that would beat right alongside your heart.
Hmm. You describe in some detail what life was like for these children who were detained at Bad Sachsel. And you also tell us how they came to have the nickname of Geisterkinder, or ghost children. And it sounds like it had something to do with their rather strange silence. Explain who observed these children and what was behind this intriguing nickname of the strange ghost children.
So there were, in some ways, the children had a relatively peaceful existence at this facility where they were held outside Bad Sachsa. You know, they weren't physically harmed. They were fed three times a day. They slept in beds. When they walked out of doors, they were forbidden from talking to one another. So the children had developed their own sort of sign language for how to communicate when they were permitted to go outside. And they were on this complex that had multiple large residences. It was like a residential complex. And as the numbers of children diminished, because some were allowed to go home, they were centralized into one of the buildings on this complex, and with others vacant, those were at one point filled by some scientists and military officers who were working nearby. And those grown-ups observed these children kind of gliding along the grass, and it, you know, in silence, and it reminded them of ghosts. So they came up with this nickname for them as the Geisterkinder, as you said, the ghost children. And the children never knew that nickname had been given to them, because these groups did not mix. And I don't think I tell the story in the book, but years later, Krista, who emigrated to the United States after the war, lives on the West Coast, was at a dinner party with other expats, and it turned out that one of the dinner guests was one of those adults who had seen these kids. And he said, "Oh my God, Krista, you were one of the ghost children." Huh. And that was how that term came to light. And it's just such a chilling description, and it captures them not just in their silence, but just the way they had their childhoods haunted, really, by these experiences.
Wow. You tell us, of course, not only about how they are treated, what they experience, but of course, ultimately, the way in which they are able to escape. And in fact, there is a lot of in a sense, strange coincidences or strokes of strange luck that allow them to survive, including one really strange instance in which an
the revenge. And the children were very benignly told, "You're going to be reunited with your families tomorrow, and pack your bags." And they did. They got on a transport vehicle. And as you said, this Allied bombing began, and they were unable to reach their train station. And had they done so, they would have been taken to, it's true, to meet up with their relatives, but their relatives were being held at Buchenwald. So they would not have been going home. They would have been going to a prison camp. And so that bombing spared them that trauma, at least. They came back to their original facility, and within days, Allied forces reached that compound and had liberated it.
Hmm. The final portion of your book talks about, in a sense, what it was like for these children to survive this and try to resume their lives, but under the shadow of a trauma that gripped many of them very, very tightly, perhaps to some extent for the rest of their lives. Just say a word about what you were able to learn about the struggles and pain that has been part of the later lives of at least many of these so-called ghost children.
Right, and I think it's worth keeping in mind that not only did they experience this this trauma of separation and uncertainty, but they returned home to a country that had been defeated, to families that had in almost all cases lost their heads of household, and so their economic circumstances had changed. The regime had spent the better part of a year branding their families as traitors. And so when they returned to school, they were pariahs and called traitors themselves. And so they had a challenging reentry into society. And also we're learning about these greater tragedies that had happened, even more horrific experiences. And so There had been no time for, you know, there were no therapists who showed up to help these people. They had to find the wood that was going to keep their fire going and just get through each day. So the trauma was pushed aside, but as we all know, that doesn't mean it goes away. Some of them were able to process it better. I spoke with one man who was 7 at the time, became a professor later on, and only later in life when he began to compile his own memories and collect those of others was he able to finally begin to talk about and process what had happened to him. And I think that was a pretty typical experience. That it took time. It took the ability to share the stories with others to come to appreciate that actually I did suffer, and I it's okay to own that and try to grow from that. And I think the diary that Krista helped, and she was one of the people I interviewed as well, that I think that diary helped her with that processing.
Well, we certainly appreciate the way in which you have told this story so very, very effectively. And I really appreciate also the fact that although this book, as I think you've already said, is at least to some extent intended for young readers, I found it utterly engrossing and fascinating start to finish. So I don't think we should limit this to younger readers. This is a book that that all of us should read who are interested in knowing more about the wide trauma that so much of the world experienced in the Second World War. The book, again, is Ensnared in the Wolf's Lair, Inside the 1944 Plot to Kill Hitler and the Ghost Children of His Revenge, published by National Geographic and the author, Anne Bossom. Anne Bossom, thank you so much for being part of the morning show today and for sharing with the world this important book.
I appreciate it. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to finish out the program with a brief conversation I recorded back in 2017 with Chris Matthews, former host of MSNBC's Hardball, and the author of a New York Times bestseller about Robert F. Kennedy, the book titled Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit. Mr. Matthews, at the end of the very first part of the book, even before the prologue, you end with these intriguing words: "This is my story of Robert F. Kennedy." Can you explain those words, how this is your story of Robert F. Kennedy?
What I wanted to do is get to the root of the man's soul. What was it that drove him throughout his life, the toughness of going after for the Kennedy family, fighting for the family, being a tough guy, even ruthless. And what drove him after that to be so focused on the minorities of the country, people in trouble? And I wanted to try to figure out, as I often do in these books, is to try to figure out the motives. Why is this guy? What made him into that? And I go back to his older boy days and his love of his mother and his rejection by his father and how he had a fight in his family for attention and how he was the odd person out, and where Jack was the favored one after Joe Jr. was the favored one because the old man wanted them to be president. And Bobby had to fight his way in that family, and he became a tough enforcer for the old man. He became a jock at Harvard and won his letter up there despite having a broken leg. And only after his father faded away with his stroke and Jack died in the assassination did Bobby really go back to who he was in the beginning, a sweet young guy trying to do the right thing. So I think I tried to go deeper than most of the other books.
Right. But why is it – I mean, I like the way you say this, but why do you say this is my story of Robert F. Kennedy rather than this is the story of Robert F. Kennedy?
Well, because I think Arthur Schlesinger told one account of him, a kind of a historic account. And Evan Thomas told his account. And I wanted to tell the Irish Catholic story of growing up in a family very similar, although not, certainly not wealthy family, you know, with the whole things we focused on. We focused on the anti-communism. We focused on the bad guys in the world. It was a kind of a rooting for Notre Dame, being into football. It was very much eating grilled cheese on Friday. I mean, I wanted to try to tell the story from the Catholic, Irish Catholic inside. And that's what I think I accomplished better than, well, no one else ever tried to tell it that way.
Right. No, I think you do a great job. And you tell us in the prologue, the years of Bobby's public life were my times too. And so this is
Well, I watched it all growing up.
Of course.
And I was only 20 years younger than him. And so I watched his passage into public life. You know, I had a vague recollection of the Rackets Committee going after the mob. But I certainly understood he was the tough guy in the campaign in 60. I certainly realized his role, his very aggressive role in fighting in the South against people like Ross Barnett in Mississippi and George Wallace and the Freedom Riders. I remember all of that, how he was hated in the South for being his brother's enforcer. So I wanted to figure him out. And I also, you know, I remember the 68 campaign. And, of course, as a college kid and a grad student, I was rooting for Gene McCarthy in the beginning. And then only in the end did I root for Bobby because and prayed for Bobby because he was the only one that could end the war, and he was willing to go out and fight Johnson on that, and then Humphrey, and that was the most emotional politics I've ever been through in my life, I think, the 68 campaign.
You say there are two main characters in Bobby's story, his brother John F. Kennedy, of course, and his father Joseph Kennedy, you've already mentioned. You tell us Bobby, of all the children, was the least like his father.
Yeah, that's what Jacqueline Kennedy said, and she meant it as a compliment, that he was a nicer guy. The old man was formidable, frightening. He took the wrong side in World War II. He was not sympathetic to Hitler, but he would tell the German ambassador von Dirksen, you know, you're not doing anything wrong over there with the Jewish people. Just you're making too big a deal about it. It was a PR problem, as Joe Kennedy saw it. I mean, that's pretty frightening. And he backed Chamberlain against Churchill. He didn't like Churchill. He didn't want Churchill's strong war position. And then the three sons come along, and Bobby included, have to sort of make up for the old man. So they all, Joe gets killed in the war with this frightening, frightening mission. He took over occupied France. Jack was disappeared for a week. They thought he was gone. Bobby tried, you know, he gave up his ROTC, went in the Navy as a Swabby, because he just wanted to get into the action at the end of the war. These kids were real patriots, whatever you think of their politics later on. The Kennedy boys were just gung-ho Americans.
One of the interesting things about your book is the contrasts you draw between Bobby Kennedy and his brother John F. Kennedy. And you'd say at one point, Jack had the charm, Bobby had the conscience. And you tell us also that they were not particularly close as brothers until 1952. It was politics that ultimately brought them together.
That's right. Their sister Eunice said that she said it was all nonsense, that these guys were two peas in a pod, that they were natural buddies. I mean, in the beginning, Jack, when Bobby came back from the Navy, it helped him in his 46 campaign, he said, he called him Black Robert. And he said, get him out of here. Send him off to some wards like the Italian wards. They weren't going to do too well in, just to get him away from people, because Jack thought that he would be a downer, a Debbie Downer in the ranks, and would kill the morale. Because Bobby hadn't really grown up yet. It wasn't until after he had played football, become a jock at Harvard, and developed some sort of personality, that he became this sort of strong character. Amazing evolution from 46 to 52, to the point where Jack let him run his campaign. And Jack said, Bobby, you're going to save my campaign and get me elected to the Senate. And afterwards, Jack said, Bobby was hated in Massachusetts. Everybody's mad at him, but he ran the best organization in the history of the state. Hmm. Bobby was a take-charge guy by 52. But in 46, he was kind of a geek. He was just uncool totally to have around you. I wrote about this for the Boston Globe. I just think football, I know football's been in, you know, and people say it hurts your head and your brain and everything these days. That's all true. But it certainly made a man out of Bobby. Certainly did.
One thing you also say, you want to really disavow us of the notion, and I've seen it in several different books, that there was one Bobby Kennedy until his brother was assassinated, and then there was a more compassionate Bobby Kennedy after that. And you really want us to let go of that simplification of who Bobby Kennedy was. He was always the person that we remember from his later years, albeit maybe sometimes that compassion was veiled by other qualities.
That's the way I wrote the book. You just had it, Greg. That's Bobby back in the, you know, there's lots of evidence of him looking at, his friends were African-American kids, even at Iannisport. He had empathy for people that didn't have the breaks he had. I mean, when Father Feeney, Leonard Feeney in Boston, came out with the philosophy of no salvation outside the church, he sort of led the fight against him, saying, you can't tell Jewish people and Protestants they're going to hell. And his mother thought he'd get excommunicated. It turns out the priest was excommunicated for that philosophy. Mm. And so he wanted Ralph Bunche, the great Nobel laureate, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, an African-American guy. He wanted him to speak at UVA when he was in law school, and all the white Southern kids were scared to death to bring him in because their political careers would be hurt back then. Of course, this is back during the days of Jim Crow. And he fought with the college president, got him to say, no, we're bringing in Ralph Bunche to speak. And not only that, but he had Ralph Bunche stay with him that night, and the people were throwing rocks at their windows, and they consider that still the safest place in town for him. So Bobby showed evidence a number of places with his high school classmate. He kept talking about, why can't we help the poor people? And they really, he was an outsider. And of course, like a lot of people, he adjusted to reality around him, and he became a tough guy. But I do believe that he became more himself. Not that he changed, but became more Bobby at the end. And became the generous guy he was as a kid. His old man would make fun of him for being generous. Some friend of the family, Lem Billings, said to the old man, you know, isn't it great how generous Bobby is? And Joe Kennedy Sr. said, I don't know where he got that from. You know, he was contemptuous of Bobby's sweetness, of Bobby's goodness. Mm.
A critic called your book a hopeful parable for our time, for our ugly times. Do you like that description? Did you want that book to be this, a hopeful parable?
Yeah, I do. I think that the scenes at the, like on the back of the book, I really want the back of the book, that dirt poor white family, little white family, husband, one son, a wife, standing at the railroad tracks as his body goes by in June of 68. They're saluting him. These people are dirt poor. They got nothing. And yet, obviously, the guy had served in the military, had a crisp salute. It's an affectionate patriotism that Bobby aroused. It was something that the Democratic Party has sort of lost. A little too aloof now and then. They don't connect with working people as well as Bobby could. And I think they need to connect with working white people as well as minorities in a way that he could. Mm. And he would like drive through a town with Richard Hatcher, the first black mayor of Gary, Indiana, on one side of him in the convertible, and Tony Zale, the great middleweight white boxer, on the other side of him to show, hey, look, I'm with everybody here. Let's get together. And as he said after King was killed that night, he said, we have to make an effort.
That was Chris Matthews, the author of Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit, published by Simon & Schuster. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, the author of a book called The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Fall and Rise of an American Icon. And Saturday, in the podcast version of The Morning Show, I'll be sharing a conversation I recorded more than 15 years ago with the late Charlotte Chell, during a time when she was on the board of directors of Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. We're approaching 9 o'clock. You're listening to WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio.